Here at Early Excellence, we specialise in early childhood education. We offer expert advice and guidance through training, consultancy and classroom design. With the Early Excellence podcast, we aim to inspire and support you as well as challenge your thinking. So if that's what you're looking for, you've come to the right place. Hello everybody, Andy Burt here. Welcome along to episode 197 of the Early Excellence podcast. In this week's episode, we're joined by Eugene Minogue, who is the Interim Executive Director at Play England. We discuss the vital importance of play and the barriers to it within society, and also what needs to happen to create a cultural shift around play. So, here you go. Here's my Early Excellence podcast chat with Eugene Minogue from Play England. Okay, so I'm delighted to say that we're joined this week on the podcast by Eugene Minogue from Play England. Eugene, great to see you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Likewise, thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. So we're going to talk about your work. We're going to talk about your work at Play England. We've got lots to cover. Just as a starting point, can you give us an introduction to your work? Would that be all right?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're Play England. Easiest way to describe us is we're the national voice for play. So we work with obviously government, local government, play workers, adventure playgrounds, and more broadly the play sector and related sectors as well to advocate for the child's right to play. All of our work is rooted in that right, which is Article 31 of the UNCRC.
Yes, and about yourself in terms of your background, your experience?
Varied. So second generation Irish immigrant, sort of raised in an area of deprivation, which really shaped me. And one of my earliest roles was play work, and then I went into youth work, and then sort of worked for local government since I was a boy, right from my school work experience, and done a whole range of different roles across local government. I now do interim and consultancy for local government and charity and third sectors, supporting them with transformation primarily, but a whole range of different things. Also in my career, I founded Parkour UK, which is the national governing body for the sport of parkour stroke free running, and also founded the International Federation as well. So founded that governing body and got the sport recognised domestically here in Britain and also internationally as well. And then joined Play England a couple of years ago to help transform the organisation and get it back to where it was, and certainly in terms of national prominence in the early 2000s.
Yes, really interesting stuff. Really, what a broad background and varied background you have. Yeah, interesting. Okay. So in terms of Play England, then you've given us that overview of the work that you do. You have a 10-year plan. Can you tell us about it? Tell us about the work specifically within that 10-year plan.
Yeah, absolutely. So in May this year, we launched our new 10-year strategy, and it's called It All Starts With Play. And that pretty much sums it up of where we are. But to give you a bit more context and detail around the strategy, it is available on our website. So we have a children's version and we have the big kids version.
Yes, I saw two different versions. I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. So children are front and center for this as well. And ultimately, it's a strategy for them and to make sure that we embody their right to play. We also have Spotify versions as well. So if you want to listen to the kids version, which is my favorite, it's about 8 or 9 minutes long and has a great soundtrack. Or you can listen to the big kids version, which is about an hour. So if you've got some time and you want to listen to a podcast, please do have a listen to our strategy. But tell you a little bit more about it. There's sort of four key elements within it. So our vision, mission, and objective. So our vision is a society where all children have the freedom to play. Our mission is to make play a normal, accepted, and visible part of everyday life. Again, the key word in there is accepted.
Yes.
We are no longer asking for permission. Children have a right to play. And as adults, we have an obligation to accept that right, but also to enable that right as well. And our objective over the next 10 years is to restore a play-based childhood for all children in England by 2035. Unfortunately, children are now growing up in a phone-based childhood, and that's certainly a significant shift. in terms of children and their right to play, but also the impact it's having in, on society, their well-being and their physical and cognitive health as well. Then we get into some of the elements of it. So our whole strategy is based on a framework for change, and that's guided by Dr. Naomi Lott's STAR framework, and that's around space, time, acceptance and rights. And that is a practical model for implementing the child's right to play. So that is a model that exists in its own right, but we've used that as our framework for change for our strategy. And Then the strategy itself has four interconnected priorities. So these won't be surprising to most people, but spaces. So this is around creating a play-friendly environment wherever children are. So whether that be at home, at school, on the street, in the parks, or the communities, but also digital spaces as well. And then the second interconnected priority is skills. So this is around recognizing and supporting people who enable play opportunities. Primarily, this is around play workers and reestablishing that workforce, but also the wider ecosystem of play enablers. So people that work in play industry, so those that design, manufacture, install, and inspect children's play facilities. But then all of us as adults, we're all play enablers.
Yes.
So within our roles as either parents or professionals, so people like architects, landscape architects, highway engineers, all of them, they all have a role to enable play opportunities. And we need a much more broader understanding of the value of play and how we need to build that in to everything that we do.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
That leads nicely into our third interconnected priority, which is systems. So this is around building a resilient play sector. So rebuilding the infrastructure for play through national policy, legislation, research and funding. And I'm sure we're going to discuss some of those things today. And then the last interconnected priority, and arguably the biggest, is society.
Yes.
And this is around renorming play as an essential accepted part of childhood. So it's around shifting the culture around this from risk aversion and control to trust, freedom and joy. And the irony was, you know, I'm an 80s baby. I had all of that when I was grown up.
Yes.
But I'm also the last generation, arguably the last generation, to benefit from that. And we've seen that change.
Yeah, definitely. Certainly. So certainly when I talk to people, you know, we run training on indoor practice, but also outdoor practice. Specifically, when we talk about outdoor practice, one of the things that we talk about at the beginning of our training is often getting people to think back to their own childhoods and where they, you know, basically their memories of outdoor play or outdoor learning and what that was like. And you hear these incredible stories of people who grew up in the 70s or 80s, perhaps, who actually, you know, were jumping off all sorts of things and exploring and creating
Absolutely.
Bridges and, you know, exploring, you know, over a whole day, you know, that kind of being out from practically the beginning of the day right the way through to when it started to get dark and then you would find your way home. There's a huge difference, isn't there, between that and young children's experiences now that tend to be very much about indoors and often, as you say, very much based around a screen.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this isn't just about being nostalgic. It's around the intrinsic benefits that come with playing outdoors, but also within the context of what children grow up in. And you heard me mention a few moments ago around digital play. You know, even me growing up in the 80s, I play digitally, albeit, you know, I'd be stood at an arcade machine, or, you know, I remember when the first PlayStation came out and the sound it made when you turn it on, genuine forms of play.
Yes.
I think where we've got to now as a society, we've sort of tipped over into the phone-based childhood. And what we mean by that is children are being dominated by social media and algorithms and the addiction that comes with that. So screens have a role to play in play, but at the same time, we do need to define what digital play is and what good looks like in terms of that. And it needs to be contextualized in today's society. So it's important. But equally, this is not about an either or. So this isn't about replacing indoor play with outdoor play or saying children should never be on screens. This is around understanding that we need to get more children playing outside in the way that certainly we did as children, because
yes.
of the benefits of that, but also the intrinsic value that brings for our children, and that's the bit that we really need to restore, but equally needs to be contextualized in today's modern world.
Yes, absolutely. It did make me think as well that within that, presumably you had to sit together as a group at Play England and define play and really sort of nail down what are we meaning by play. because you're right, you know, it covers and can cover such a broad spectrum of things, from playing online to playing physically outdoors. It could be play as in a something that you pay to go into, as in like a children's party type ball pool adventure area, or it could be something that is free. There are a wide range of different things to do with play, aren't there? As well as playful learning that you would expect to see within a classroom. You know, there's a broad range, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And our strategy title says it on the tin. It all starts with play.
Yes.
In terms of defining play, it's been well defined for a long time, particularly through the UNCRC, and we're very clear on that. And we've had to restate this in our strategy because, you know, most people know what play is, but not necessarily the definition of play. So play is a fundamental way that children explore, imagine, connect with, and make sense of the world.
Yes.
It's how they express themselves, they build relationships, develop resilience, and experience joy. Yet, despite its central role in healthy development and well-being, play is often misunderstood, undervalued, or seen as frivolous, and that's where we've got to,
yes,
rather than seen to being essential to childhood. But in other words, you know, play is freely chosen, so it's not directed or imposed by us as adults, hence why we're moving away from permission to the term acceptance. It should be self-directed and self-structured, shaped by children's instincts, their ideas, and their imagination. It should be intrinsically motivated, done for its own sake, not for a task or performance. And here's a key one. It's essential to child's well-being, learning, and development. So these are things that we have to remind ourselves as adults, because essentially we forget that we are big kids. But also as a society as well, we often do things for adults, by adults, and forget about children.
Yes, yeah. And I think you're right as well. In earlier on when you were talking about your 10-year plan, that was so incredibly broad, which is really interesting. Within it, you talk about that basically changes within society so that we are understanding what young children need. And so whether that be architects or designers, for example. And I think that's really interesting because, you know, I work with schools in terms of designing classroom spaces. So not the structure, not the physical space in terms of the four walls, but actually what's going into it in terms of the furniture and creating the zones and the spaces that children are needing. And what's really interesting to me is that it's very common that decisions have already been made by the time I start my bit of the job that actually are restricting. So, for example, non-slip flooring within a classroom can often be a really limited amount of space. And yet what we know that young children need is all sorts of sensory experiences. They need a broad range of sensory experiences like sand and water and dough play and paint and workshop and all of those sorts of things. But then already the decision's been made by the architect that actually you're only going to have this small bit of non-slip flooring. So you're going to have to choose one of those things. Do you see what I mean? And it made me think of that when you were sharing kind of that broad aim, really, in terms of the 10-year plan.
You're absolutely right. And the key word there, the decision's been made by the architect.
Yes.
And that this is hence lies the problem. Us as adults, we not only create the environments that children grow up in, but we continue to curate that environment.
Yes.
And the easiest way to articulate that, you know, we design virtually all of our built environment around the default of the car. Now, if we can design a system that way, why can't we design that very system to design everything around children? As a general rule of thumb, if we design for children, it is generally good for everybody.
Yes.
Those with disabilities, older people, societally more generally, but also, you know, I think the lens that, and I said this in the DCMS Select Committee, we must remember children make up 20% of our population, but 100% of our future. And we don't value children in that way. We treat them as frivolous, or they don't really understand or can't contribute to society yet. And that's quite the opposite with that. And we really need to put children right at the heart of decision making with that, whether that's about their learning, whether it's about the built environment, any aspects of their life. Children should, their voice should be heard, as it says under the UNCRC, but we don't treat children that way.
No, sure. It is very interesting in that idea of making sure that young children are seen and heard in terms of play is a broader issue, isn't it? In that what you're actually saying is we need to make sure that children are seen and heard and feel valued, and that the way that we are going to go about doing that is by making sure that they have spaces where they can express themselves and can play and can collaborate and have their own ideas and all of those sorts of things. But actually, it's about society recognizing the value of children and childhood.
Absolutely. And that's there in a nutshell. That's what we're trying to do through our strategy. The big one is, the big one to shift the dial is going to be a society and getting that. The irony is everybody's experienced play. We're big kids. We've all played. We all know how to play.
Yeah.
With that, and the irony is, if you look at what we do as adults, we build a lot of play for adults into society, whether that's places like pubs or nightclubs or leisure centres or swimming pools or sports pitches. So these are all built for adults by adults through an adult lens, and then we try and retrofit the children to it. We need the same level of attention for children and young people, so we need the environment to reflect a more playful environment and a place that not just enables it, but facilitates it.
Yes.
As well. We've all had that, you know, children will play anywhere they're given the opportunity to do so. Us as adults are often play deniers, not play enablers down from there. Don't do that. Don't jump in the puddle. Or if the kids are dancing around in the aisle of Tesco, we sort of say, oh, stop being silly. They're actually enjoying themselves. That's part of a childhood, is part of growing up. We should celebrate and accept that and facilitate it with it all. And particularly when it comes to our learning environments, you know, the way the education system is currently set up, we are trying to churn out these people that are going to contribute to GDP and be good workers for a world that has come and gone. You know, we're way behind in terms of what we're doing with our children and young people. And we need to have a fundamental and profound shift in education. I said earlier, our children are growing up in a phone-based childhood. That phone-based childhood is rapidly going to be replaced with an AGI-based childhood, so an artificial general intelligence childhood. There are inherent benefits of that. So what is going to make people more employable in the future is their humanity. The people are, you know, general intelligence is going to be everywhere. So for the last couple of centuries, we was employed for our intelligence and our skills and what we could do. Prior to that, it was obviously industrial. It was all around what labor and what toil we could bring. My view is in the future, people are going to be much more employable for their humanity. And when you look through that lens, people are going to have to develop their EQ and their SQ, so their emotional intelligence and their social intelligence. That all starts with play. That's where play really brings richness and value. And we need to be bringing that back into our education system and facilitating that. So as an example, Scandinavian countries currently, they do this much better than us. So as an example, in kindergarten, that's a 45-minute 15 rule. So for every 45 minutes of learning, they have 15 minutes of genuine recess where the kids can, like you said earlier, can go out and play with sand, get wet, get a bit dirty, you know, jump around in puddles and play and have a kick around or whatever it may be with that. But it's free play. The children can go do that.
Yes. And there's value in that. That's the thing. It's not frivolous, is it? There is value in it. There's value in exploration, there's value in collaboration and problem solving and all kinds of different things that actually children will often encounter through play and through something which for them is intrinsically motivating, isn't it? They want to do it. This is not about an adult saying, oh yeah, you need to do this, then this, then this, and then kind of get exciting to the child. This is about the child seeing something as interesting already. And that Absolutely. In itself is valuable, isn't it? I think
it is. And you see how animated I got when you said that. Here's the irony is this, as adults, we seem to forget this. We've come up with the term that play is frivolous. When you was a child, it never was. That was the best thing you could be doing. And the learning that you got from that was so rich from it. And I think this is the thing that we need to remind ourselves as adults. What did we want and what did we need when we was children? And you need play. You need that unstructured free play. You need the time to go and explore, be mischievous, engage with risk, do things that you probably shouldn't be doing with that. And that's part of the joy of it. You know, that's part of the learning. You know, that's the bits that we've now stripped out from childhood. You know, I've been as bold to say at times, I think we are robbing our children of a childhood these days. And it goes back to that statement I made earlier. As us as adults, we not only create the environment that children grow up in, we continue to curate that environment.
Yes.
And it's incumbent on us to change that.
Yeah, absolutely. Which leads us on quite nicely, I think, to barriers to that. Barriers and obstacles. That there are, I think, anyway, quite a few barriers, quite a few obstacles to children's play and to children having those experiences that we are talking about. Presumably, your work at Play England brings you into contact with some of those barriers.
Yes, front and centre. And a lot of it is just around calling it out with it all. And the barriers are vast. The easiest way to describe it is us as adults, which is the biggest barrier. In the built environment, and then we spoke about this earlier, the number one thing is traffic with that. The way that we design, or I live in a cul-de-sac. It's only 30 houses on the street, very fortunate to live in it. The whole design of the street was done to get the refuse collection vehicle in for it to be able to turn around and get back out. Predominantly drop curbs, so virtually every house has a couple of parking spaces, and people still park on the street, even though they've got the parking spaces outside there. Not a single tree on the street. It so happens the hammerhead of the street where the refuse collection vehicle turns around is great for play with that. And we've put stuff out with it all. We got some goals out there and some bits for the children to play with. But it wasn't designed from that perspective. But there's lots of stuff that we can and should do that can facilitate play. Now, we applied the same rigor of designing around the car, but designing around children. Imagine what that street would have looked like or could have looked like with it all. Yes. It's a very simple question with it all. And often we don't need, you know, fixed play. A lot of time children just need a space or an opportunity to play, you know, a tree swing or a grassed area that they can congregate in with their friends. You know, there's great games, colloquial games from Britain. Kirby's a prime example.
Yeah, it is.
You know, that
yeah,
was yeah. born out of the built environment with it all. But yet we've told children they can't do that anymore. The way, where we've got to as a society, we see children playing out as something that needs to be managed or something that's dangerous or illegal or antisocial. And it isn't. We all did it as kids. You know, my mum used to literally chase me out of the house and say, "Don't come back to the streetlights, Rod." And we was in and out of other people's houses. That built up all the community resilience, you know, the connections across the neighborhood, not just with other friends. You know, friends are, they only become friends. They were all strangers at one point. And, you know, primarily that was facilitating.
And the skills you're developing through that.
Correct. And, you know, simple things. I said to my son over the summer holidays, I said to him, "Are you going to go and knock for Josh, who lives across the road?" He looked at me perplexed. Why would I knock for Josh? I just texted him. I was like, "No, Charlie." I said, "Go and knock on the door." "Well, what? Why?" "Well, Stevie's in." I said, "Moreover, you don't know who's going to answer the door. It might be Josh's dad, might be Josh's mom. What would you say to him? He might not even be in. Nobody might answer the door." So all of these are small skills that I did as a child repeatedly.
Yes.
Knocking for my friends and going seeing, you know, "Are they there? They're not there." No, so-and-so's not here. They're down the park. Okay, ride down to the park. Go down there. They're not there. Go look. Yeah. They're small interactions that build up your resilience, your communication skills, your community connections. Somebody else's mum knew I was their mate and other bits, and they knew my mum, vice versa. So all of these connections are being lost because you don't have the facilitation or the intergenerational play aspects. You know, we spoke about Kirby few minutes ago.
Yeah, yeah.
My children don't know how to play it because I hadn't showed them how to play it yet.
Yeah, that's the thing. There's a kind of a handing down process from older children to younger children that happens, isn't there? And from
Absolutely.
Generation to generation. Interestingly, one of the obstacles you talked about was traffic. And I think the time that we're talking about from what the 1970s and 80s through to the present day, you've seen a huge increase in traffic. And, you know, a huge increase in the number of cars on the road and number of cars parked on roads in residential streets. Whereas actually probably in the 70s and 80s, you wouldn't have that number parked there, meaning that actually there was space to ride your bike or space to have a game of football that you'd have to pack away every time a car came. It wasn't just completely stop start because of the traffic. You did have spells where you could become engaged in something. And I guess that's a pattern, isn't it, that you probably see up and down the country in terms of traffic?
Yeah, it's not just a pattern. It's willful. It's us as adults that, again, we've created that environment and we continue to curate that environment.
Yes.
Now, as an example, the National Model Design Code from the government has over 100 references to parking. In that same document, there's less than 20 around play.
Gosh, yeah.
So it goes to show you how we as adults are Yes, and this is what's happened. So we've had this decade upon decade of doubling down around the car-centric sort of view of the world. And that has squeezed play out, not solely, but we've squeezed it out virtually of all aspects of society. You know, children, from the moment they wake up now to the moment they go to the bed, their day is structured. You need to be here doing this at this time with so-and-so, and they get passed from pillar to post. So we've eradicated things like boredom.
I was going to say
and
boredom.
Mischief.
It's key, yeah. Isn't it? Boredom is key. It's the sort of, I suppose, it's the fertile ground, isn't it, boredom, where actually you can then have ideas and be creative. The space in your mind, because you're a bit bored and you're wandering, to then think, oh, I could do this, or my mind might wander, or whatever. I don't get the impression, I may be completely wrong because this is a generalization, but I don't get the impression that young children get that chance now in quite the same way. There's such a lot that they're bombarded by.
Absolutely, yeah. They've been overstimulated with that. So, you know, and Jonathan Haidt talks about this in his book in The Anxious Generation. So does Johan Hari in his book, Stolen Focus, how we've filled that gap with the stuff that we spoke about earlier, the algorithms, the social media, the frivolous sort of stuff. And that stuff is frivolous. It is stealing that attention. But we seem to think that that is okay. We sort of said to our children, this is a broad brush, we sort of said to our children for the last two generations, don't go outside and play. The world's dangerous. It's wet, it's dirty, don't go out there. And now children have retreated to their bedroom with a screen, virtually unregulated, and that's where we've got to. There was a piece of research done several years ago by Dr. William Burbert, shows a free range of movement of a couple of generations. So great-grandparents typically around about 6 miles, and then you get to sort of my children's generation, and that's shrunk down to a couple of hundred yards. If that was updated today, I suspect it's not even a couple of hundred yards. We're talking about the bedroom. That's where it's shrunk to.
Down to feet, I think.
Yeah, so the physical world has shrunk for our children and young people. We're telling them we can't go anywhere. But the digital world, we're saying, you can go anywhere. Go off, go free and do this. Yeah. And it's having a huge impact. And COVID really demonstrated that now. We're seeing the effects of that coming out the other side. And one of the biggest things we can do for our children is give them their childhood back. You know, as we've been saying to government, you know, it's great that they got this housing target. Children don't just need a home. They need a childhood. Yes. And to have a childhood, it all starts with play.
Absolutely. Which brings us on to outdoor play specifically. And I know we've touched on it a little bit, talking about cars and vehicles and talking about the street. But it strikes me that actually what you're talking about is much more than that, that you're not just talking about freeing up the streets for potentially to have some spaces for play, which I know is something that does go on and is becoming something that's more common. But we're talking about more than that. We're talking about play spaces in parks and other areas.
Yeah, I think the point you make on streets, I really want to emphasize it, because there were several reasons for this. One is, it is the most democratic place to play. And by default, kids ruled the streets, literally ruled the streets. You know, if you went round, even post-First, Second World War, kids were, that's a default place. You know, there was no such thing as a playground. You know, adventure playgrounds started to emerge, and, you know, derelict sites and, you know, people making their own versions of play and other bits and pieces. But we need to really understand that we've taken that space away from children over the last 70, 80 years. We've stolen that space as adults from children. And the irony was, even, you know, a generation as ours, we used to play out in the streets. This is what we did. It's where you went. You know, that was the default place that we did. And you had all sorts of things that would happen from that. We spoke about some of them already, but, you know, the community connections and resilience around there. But, you know, simple things when I was doing, you know, give you an example, I was doing the consultation on our new strategy with some children and young people in Norwich. And so we went out and was doing an engagement session with us. And they said to me, sir, can we present to you around our thoughts first? I was like, yeah. I said, as long as you don't call me sir anymore. So they did. They've done theirs. And I said to them, look, I need to scrap virtually all of my presentation. And let me tell you how I played as a child, because they had all the right answers. We want more space in parks. We want this. We want more digital space. We want to have time at school, all the other bits and pieces, all of the usual stuff that they want. But then when I explained to them how I played as a child and the things that I did, they said to me, you did what? You went where? And social services wasn't called? I said, well, occasionally. Or you didn't get into trouble. I said, well, yes, occasionally, because that's part of play. You mischievous. You'd do things and you'd explore and do other bits and pieces. But just things like, where I'd like going down to the graveyard to pick conkers, or the stuff that I would do in school. And, you know, me walking to school at 8 or 9 at primary school, go, what do you mean you went to school by yourself and you didn't get taken? I was like, no. And I'd play on the way, we'd do all of these things, or you climb on the garages, you know, you'd play on the estate or up the flats. You know, these are things that were just an accepted part of childhood. But for some reason now, we've stripped all of that away from children and said to them, if you want to play, you need to go there and with them to do that. And that's not what play is. Play, particularly free play, is so important. And playing outside isn't just good for children, it's good for society. You know, there's all the inherent benefits that sort of come with that. You know, the community resilience, the eyeballs, people knowing that they can travel from, to, and through stuff. So this stuff isn't just about play itself. It's around how you get to playing. It's like my place was the park. We used to love going to the park.
Yeah.
But how we got there, I'd probably cycle down to my mate's house, knock on the door, say, you coming out? And then we'd cycle down to the park. And then we'd play in the typical sense of the term. But all of that on the way is so important around understanding your community, seeing that space as yours. It's this infrastructure is here for me with that. You know, all of these things, we just give people saddles and croggies, you know, trip knots on our bikes. And, you know, all of these things have just been lost. But this is the inherent value of playing outdoors. Then there's all the community connections, all the community resilience that come with that. And people know each other. But then that intergenerational play has been lost. So,
yes. You know,
the handed down of games, whether it be things like Kirby or skipping or run outs or 40.
There's loads, aren't there?
There's massive amounts of stuff that we've just lost, you know, and then simple things. Then we've eradicated from the school day. So, you know, don't play on the playground. You can't do that. And that's the number one thing that hits our inbox. The amount of emails we get saying, can you tell the school to let the kids play before, during, or after school with it all? And we've just squeezed it out. And then when you apply it to an academic sense, you know, and some of the reporting is in the Play Commission report around this, how there's 23 minutes less per day that children are playing within school. You know, it's crucial. And then also there's things now that have been squeezed, even when you have break time. When I was at school, it wasn't break time, you had play time.
Yeah.
Literally go off and let off some steam and tear around the playground.
Yeah.
And then you had what are now called lunchtime supervisors. My day was the dinner lady would come out and make sure we weren't taking lumps out of each other. But the great thing that they used to do with us, they used to play games with us. That's how I learned to skip as a child. Yeah. French skipping, it was because they knew how to do it. They showed us the games, or whether it was playing bulldog or whatever it was. They would help with that at playtimes. Like now, if you speak to my children who are in their teens, you know, their lunchtime is their lunchtime. And within that lunchtime, they've got to get out of one lesson, queue up for lunch, get the lunch, have something to eat, rush along, and then get to their next lesson. Virtually no time for play. And it's all gone. And then the moment they finish school, it's like, right, get out, off you go. Whereas for me, after school, we used to have a kick around on the playing fields and hang around for a couple of hours. You know, this is, it's just all been squeezed out.
Yeah. No, definitely. The other thing that occurred to me as well from what you were saying just before, when you mentioned about sort of design and that kind of the adult role in designing our children's world, one of the things that I thought about was children's playgrounds and how they have changed over time. And that if you look at sort of the earliest versions of kind of adventure playgrounds, there were these incredible kind of spaces with open-ended material for children to go and get, you know, barrels and all kinds of different sort of planks of wood and to challenge themselves and kind of climb over things and clamber over things and create obstacle courses and have imaginative play and all sorts of things like that. And over time, they have become something that is just static. And there's value in that. And I get that, you know, that actually there is some value in, you know, a cargo net and a slide and a climbing frame. And yes, children will enjoy it. But it does strike me that over time, these spaces have changed dramatically, really.
They've not just changed, they've been lost. So in my lifetime since 1980, we've lost over half of the adventure playgrounds in England. These are civic treasures. You know, the adventure play, I had the privilege of going to one when I was a child. You know, you'd get to everything from make cakes to throwing axes, playing with fire, building your own dens, you know, getting a cutting a scrape here and there and other bits and going down zip wires and all sorts. These are valuable spaces that we've lost. Yeah. And the irony is these were born out of, the war, really, derelict places where children would go and play and probably do things that they shouldn't be. Yeah, as they did. But here's the irony. So I spent 10 years on the British Standards Committee for Children's Play, looking after a document called EN 1176 around health and safety of children's playground. You look around the room, predominantly these were middle-aged white men who played on these very bombed-out building sites at the end of the Second World War, who are now dictating that children can't jump off something greater than 60 centimetres that they might get a long limb fracture. It's like we can't eliminate, nor should we eliminate, all risk. Children need risk in their life so that they can engage with it, manage it, learn from it. You can't fully eradicate risk. There are some unacceptable risks that we should, and that's fine. But we've gone too far the other way. Plus, there's a whole generation, generations now, that have grown up without the privilege of going to an adventure playground. These places were often just a scrap of land somewhere with, a load of material that children would then make their own playgrounds and do things and make dens, like you said, dens and build fires and create their own spaces with that. And we've lost those, and that's a real sin. And on top of that, it goes hand in glove with the play workers. Play workers as a workforce have been absolutely decimated, and that is a direct correlation with adventure playgrounds, but also then how play is treated more societally with that. I said this at the DCMS Select Committee, children don't just land here age 13. Children need play within their life, a fundamental aspect of it. Play workers have a key role to play with that. And for me, children should have, every child should have the opportunity to go to an adventure playground. And when I say an adventure playground, I mean a genuine adventure playground, yes. Not these big playgrounds now that are often behind, paywalls or other bits. They have value as well as does fixed play.
Sure.
But this isn't either or, this isn't and.
It's a different thing, isn't it? It's not the same.
Fundamentally.
Thing. Yeah.
And this is some of the stuff that people like you and me understand, but we need society to understand that. And the irony is most people of our generation and prior to that would have gone or have benefited from an adventure playground. If they didn't have one in their community, they probably would have done some of the stuff that you would have done at an adventure playground in their community. So these are things that we need to give back to our children. We need to give them back their childhood in terms of that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Which brings us on to, as we sort of draw things to a close, I'm aware of time, really, in terms of your time as much as anything else. But this is really interesting stuff, really interesting. What comes next then? You've got your 10-year plan. You're clearly working with lots of different people on the importance of play and on developing play spaces and making changes to society. What comes next for you within that?
A deep breath. There's lots with it all. Obviously, our big aim is around restoring that play-based childhood over the next years. And it is going to take that long time to move the needle, because we have robbed our children of a childhood. And we've now got societal systems that push back against this all the time.
Yes.
And to undo that, it's not being brave. It's not doing anything innovative. This is around just thinking around the consequences. So to give you a very simple example, one of the earliest wins we had with the new government was getting the smoking ban extended to children's playgrounds. So when we was having the conversation with government and we pointed this out, the simple response to it was, what do you mean it's illegal to smoke in a pub but it's not in a playground? Yes. And the simple answer to, I was asked, well, why? I said, I don't know, I wasn't in government at the time. I said, but if I'm being generous, I think it's because the way that we do stuff, we design things for adults by adults, and children get forgotten. And again, this all, you could apply that same sort of thinking to all aspects of society. We often do to children as opposed to doing with or doing for. So we really need to shift that way. So we had that. We had the change in the national planning policy framework. We had the first debate in Parliament in 17 years on play. We've continued to build on that momentum. We had the place efficiency amendment, which unfortunately didn't get voted against with that. But we've secured a key concession out of government for that. That was back in June. They've made good on that. So they're now consulting on an updated national planning policy framework, which actually got published earlier this week. Consequently, as well, they're looking at the National Model Design Code, which I spoke about earlier. make baking play into that as well. So we've made some real progress. We had the 18 million announced from government investment in playgrounds. That is a start. That's not an end point. This is about yes and. This isn't about no but.
It's keeping pushing, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's the same messages every time, isn't it, from you? You know, saying to whoever is listening and knocking on doors, presumably, to say, actually, you know, this is important, that the children don't have a voice in this.
So absolutely.
Actually, it does come down to somebody like you and your colleagues at Play England to really push those messages. And that is important, isn't it? It's crucial.
It is fundamentally important. And again, going back to my DCMS Select Committee oral evidence, I actually called the politicians out on it. I said to them, you need to stand up and be the child's voice in Parliament. You need to advocate for our children and young people with that. So we need to keep pushing. You know, we've got the APPG re-established now on Play. So we had our first meeting in September. We've had three meetings since, and that's already yielding positive results. We've got a really good forward plan for that as well. One of the things I do want to highlight is the great work that Ruth Culley has done around the petition for play-based learning.
Yes.
We've got a specific session on Play in schools and education coming up with the APPG again to highlight this to parliamentarians with that. So these are small things, but when these number of small things come together and they start to compound, we start to make a compelling case for it. But we need people across society, across professions, across sectors to be that child's voice. But also always remember that thing. We always have an opportunity multiple times every day to enable a play opportunity as opposed to denying it. And these are things that we can just think about. And often we just need to remember we are big kids and what the children want more than the opportunity to play.
Yeah, powerful stuff. Really powerful stuff. For people who are, and I'm sure people will be, listening to this and very interested in your work, can you just tell them about, you know, where they can find out more about the work of Play England?
Yeah, absolutely. If you go to our website, that's the easiest place to find it. So two key pages on there is strategy, so /strategy, and then the other one /newsblog as well, which gives you the updates of what we're doing. The APPG information is on there as well. One thing I do want to point out about the strategy is it's a blueprint, but it's also an invitation. That strategy is very deliberate. We can't, nor should we, deliver all of that. It's incumbent on society, all aspects, government, planners, others, people like yourselves. So it's an invitation for people to join, use it, lean into it, put it under the noses of people, take it, steal it, copy it, paste it. I don't care. You know, we want more play for our children. And especially at this time of year, festive season, what greater gift can we give our children and giving them their childhood back?
Yeah, absolutely. Eugene, it's been brilliant to chat to you. Thank you so much. Your work is really, really interesting. And I wish you all the best with it. It's really, really important stuff. Thank you.
Thank you.
So there you go. Thank you very much to Eugene for joining us for this episode of the podcast. And of course, to you people for listening along as well. That's about it from us for this week. Have a good week, everybody, and we will see you next time.